He had a very clear view of lights on the corners of the triangle. It's part of a stunning global pattern that's reported by people from all walks of life, as well as military and law enforcement personnel.
That doesn't fit any type of known aircraft that I'm aware of.
So we are joined today by Mr. David Marler, an independent researcher who is widely known in the field of UAP research as the foremost expert on triangular UFOs. In 2013, he published the book Triangular UFOs, An Estimate of the Situation. David has served as the Illinois State Director of the Mutual UFO Network, the largest civilian research organization in the country devoted to the study of unexplained aerial phenomena. He has lectured on the subject to many academic and civilian audiences over the years. Mr. Marler has assisted multiple major television networks like the History Channel, Discovery Channel, and the Smithsonian Channel with their productions on UFOs over the years. David, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Your book, Triangular UFOs, came out in 2013, like I said before. And since then, obviously, a great deal has happened in the field of UFO research. And how has your understanding of this phenomenon changed, if at all, in the last couple of years, for example?
Sure. I don't know so much if it's really changed so much, Austin, as it's just really become more validated, if you will, with the recent disclosures on the part of official sources, the Pentagon, of course, the famous Pentagon UAP report, which I know many people take a lot of issue with it because it lacked substance. But fundamentally, for someone like myself, who's been doing this for 32 years now actively, it was a game changer as far as official acknowledgement of the phenomenon, whatever that phenomenon is. Again, historically over the years, I've always used the term UFO in the literal sense as unidentified flying object. It's not saying we're being invaded by aliens. I'm not saying I subscribe to the extraterrestrial hypothesis. But as we now have the official stamp and seal of approval, there is a mystery. There's unidentified objects moving in our quote unquote controlled airspace. I use the term loosely because obviously we have these things flying around that we don't know where they are, why they're here. But it's really just been validating. And just recently, quite literally in the course of the last year, my research has focused on a whole new subset of data, which hopefully we'll talk about in the course of the show, where I've identified over 102 additional historical triangular UFO reports from contemporaneous reports dating back to the 1950s, 60s, and 70s.
Could you do that for us? Could you situate your research, you know, in the landscape of ufology, of the study of UAP?
Absolutely, Michael. My interest really is wide sweeping. I sometimes get somewhat stereotyped like an actor from a 1960s TV show where they think I only did this one role. I have a huge historical archive and, you know, really, I think a wide working knowledge of the history of the subject in general as it pertains to UFO sightings, landings, abductions, et cetera, government involvement. But quite often I get pigeonholed into this triangular UFO category, and people think that's all I investigate. In fact, I receive reports all the time. I know you investigate triangles, but would you be interested in this UFO report? And I'm like, yes, I'm interested in the subject in general, in the much larger context. In 2012, I had been doing lectures on the triangular UFO subset for about 12 years. Really, it was in 2000, investigating a famous case that really personally got me involved, although I became actively involved in 1990. And at that time, one of the most prevalent themes or discussion topics was the famous wave of triangular UFOs in Belgium. So when I first got involved, that was really kind of in vogue, if you will, for the time, for the field of ufology. And it just captured my attention. I've always kind of relegated these triangular UFOs to the category I call unambiguous UFO sightings. We're not talking a point of light that someone saw move in a straight line across the sky for 2 seconds. That could have been a meteor or just a glare on the eye. These things are structured, clearly structured objects of some type, exhibiting some type of technology, for lack of a better term. And, you know, these triangular UFOs are really a completely different subset within the field, as opposed to little points of light or distant high altitude objects. And so I thought at the time, I really want to kind of focus my attention on that. And at that time, I was still developing my archive, albeit it was probably a fraction of what it is today, and started going through looking at other historical triangular UFO reports. And really, the impetus for that was seeing a lot of commentary on the internet and social media where people saying, well, these triangles are new to the UFO phenomenon. therefore they must be military. And that's still a prevailing thought or argument or idea that still circulates in the field. But as I've tried to outline in my book, and as I mentioned, just in the course of the last year, going through historic files, which just touching on that, in November of 2020, I received the largest historical case file collection. And this included the case files from NICAP, the National Investigation Committee on Aerial Phenomenon, as well as the Center for UFO Studies, which also incorporates Dr. J. Allen Hynek's original Project Blue Book files. And so it's really one of the largest historical repository of sightings. And I decided no researcher historically had ever gone through specifically looking for triangular UFO reports in this huge data set. So over the course of the last calendar year, I have been focused on going through 13 four and five drawer file cabinets of news clippings, case files, reports, and found over 102 triangular UFO reports. What's important about this, these are contemporaneous reports from the 1940s, 50s, 60s, 70s. This isn't someone that just sent me an email saying in 1960, I saw this. These are dated from that time period. So It's easy for anyone to just say, well, triangular UFOs are now in style, so I'm going to say I saw one back in 1950. No, these are historical documents from that time period. What's interesting about that, beyond just triangular UFOs, they describe in detail, and it's really the best outside validation for my research and my book, the exact same characteristics that I created as a working profile back in 2013. And so I'm not saying that some triangles today aren't military. I think it might be a little combination of both that people are seeing, because I don't know what state-of-the-art technology is. I'm not involved in those compartmentalized classified projects. But I think it's a strong argument when you look at the data that these things have been around much longer than the 1970s and 80s, as many people put forth.
Mm-hmm. Early in your book, you put a table up from the UFO Center, and where it pretty clearly lays out the statistical significance of triangle UFO sightings. And I remember when I saw it again, going back to take a look through the book this past week, I remembered from back in college when Austin had shown me that exact table, and I think it is just sort of immediately compelling. But what do you make of that statistical significance?
Well, clearly there has been an uptick in triangular UFO reports. As I mentioned, there is a historical precedence looking at the 50s, 60s, et cetera. But clearly in the 1970s, 1980s, there was an increase in sightings. Again, I think that trying to find one simplistic explanation for all of this is somewhat simplistic in an approach. We are seeing, obviously, in the 80s and the 90s, the advent of stealth technology that became widely known. We know of the B-2 stealth bomber. We know of the F-117A. Those things are antiques. We are, I'm sure, two or three or four stages beyond that. So again, some of these triangles that are being cited that do not exhibit the exotic characteristics that I outlined could be military. For example, about 7-8 years ago, approximately over Wichita, Kansas, a professional photographer shot photographs of a clear equilateral triangle moving at high altitude. He had an extreme telephoto lens. Austin, do you remember that one?
Yes. I that was posted. I browse. I will fully admit that I browsed the UFO subreddit on Reddit. And I remember seeing that picture maybe back when we were in college, Michael, I don't know what the exact coloration on it was, but it's got a clear contrail to it too.
So that's the point I was going to bring up. Thank you jumping ahead there, because it's exactly the point I was going to bring up. When we see a triangle, whether it's equilateral or otherwise, and we see characteristic conventional contrails, clearly, that's something that we manufactured. I mean, that is emblematic, indicative of traditional jet propulsion technology. And that probably was the successor to the B-2 stealth that someone happened to capture with a telephoto lens flying over Wichita. The ones that I'm particularly interested in, because any UFO researcher or investigator out there, anyone that's followed the subject knows, 90% of the reports we get can probably be explained in conventional terms. The ones that I'm interested in are the equilateral triangles that are reported flying with the flat side as the leading edge. In other words, the apex of the triangle is trailing behind, and you have this flat, blunt side, basically as aerodynamic as a brick trying to fly through the air, moving in that direction. What's interesting is we have modern day accounts of that. But again, going back to the 1950s and 60s, we have reports of that same characteristic. And in fact, quite often when we talk about historical case files and records, we think papers, documents. Prior to doing my historical research on the NICAP CUFOS case files, my project prior to that, I just have one project after another, as my wife will tell you, was digitizing over 221 reel-to-reel audio recordings. These were donated through my friend and colleague, Rod Dyke from Seattle, who purchased the audio collection from NICAP in the 1990s. Since he realized I had the files, he said, "David, we need to reunite this information. I want to give you these tapes if you can get them digitized," which I did. And in fact, I just received another two boxes 2 days ago, which I'm sorting through this weekend, quite literally. But what's interesting is in those interviews from the 1950s and 60s, there's a case from Pennsylvania 1964, where I had the case file already incorporated into my presentation for this year, showing a sketch of a triangle with arrows indicating that the flat side was the leading edge. With the contribution of those tapes, I now have interview excerpts with the witness from 1964 that I'm able to incorporate. Wow. So I like to talk about these cases, but when I present to an audience, there's nothing better than when you can hear it in the witness's own words.
Oh, yeah.
And so being able to present audio as well as the documents. And in fact, another one is from Rochester, Minnesota. Same year, I believe, 1964. And there was a gentleman who was working at a golf course around 12:30 at night. And he saw an equilateral triangle with bright lights, one at each point, characteristic of the modern day reports. And we have detailed interviews with him. And I was able to digitize and digitally remaster that. And so in addition to presenting visually the sketches, the eyewitness testimony, the written testimony, in some cases, we even have audio recordings from the 1960s and 70s.
Sort of like an interesting subset of like the triangular UFO data that I've seen is a lot of people reporting like really, really large boomerang shaped craft. Like how often have you come across that description in your research?
I come across that quite a bit, Austin. And it's so funny because people will ask me, well, why didn't you include this case in your book? Or why? Well, first off, as I prefaced in the book, if you remember, I can only consolidate so many cases in a book. I mean, I tried to take some of the best cases, some of the multiple witness cases. But people have different definitions when we talk about triangular UFOs. In the book, for those that have seen it, I tried to adhere to true triangular reports. But admittedly, once you get into that, it gets rather murky because you have triangles that have little notches taken out of the back, which then take on more of an appearance of a V or boomerang or chevron-shaped object. So as I like to say, where do you draw the line when you're trying to categorize these? It's kind of shades of gray as far as trying to fit them in there. And I've had many people ask, well, how come you didn't touch on the Phoenix Lights case in your book? Well, I didn't, but I had Peter Davenport towards the end of the book touch on it because I wasn't directly involved in that investigation. And Peter was my friend at the National UFO Reporting Center. So he touched on it. But again, much has been written, much has been discussed. Really, the impetus for the book was to share these rare cases that people have never seen or heard about before. And that's one of my issues I take with production companies doing these documentaries. How many times are we going to touch on Roswell? How many times are we going to touch on Bentwaters? They have about 5 or 10 cases that they beat to death. There are literally sitting next to me, I have the NICAP CUFOS case file collection here. There's tens of thousands of reports. Most people have never seen these cases or reports before. And some of these involve radar confirmation, not just eyewitness reports.
I think a lot of times that focus on a few well-known cases, it comes down to a crisis of credibility. And so if you can, you know, key on these instances that people are familiar with, that you can seem more credible. But it seems like maybe as this topic moves more and more into the mainstream, that we might see, a broader appetite or an increased level of credibility for people who want to talk about other cases, other sightings.
Well, Michael, I couldn't agree with you more. And the thing that I'm bringing up in my lectures this year is the fact that we are now looking this year, believe it or not, the 75th anniversary of the modern age of flying saucers. You know, Kenneth Arnold had his sighting 75 years ago this coming June, which is just hard to wrap our minds around. And when you think about that, in the general worldwide scope of looking at the UFO subject, we have 7.5 years, decades worth of civilian and military UFO reports. There is no shortage of data. The issue that we have, though, is trying to consolidate that data. Everyone's sitting on little data sets. And I've really been very fortunate over the course of really the last year. I was involved with Ross Coulthart's documentary in Australia, The Phenomenon, for 7 Network. And as a result of that, I've gotten a lot of emails from international sources with UFO reports or people doing their own research. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I don't care to do these documentaries much, to be quite honest with you, because I'm very picky about the quality and the caliber. But I will say Ross was a true pleasure to work with. He's a true gentleman. And I think he did a remarkable job on that documentary. But they do serve a purpose. It gets my name out there to where if people have had sightings that fall in line with the triangles, they know who to go to. In fact, I just had a gentleman from Rome contact me, Rome, Italy, with some information, and a gentleman from Germany that I still need to respond to that reached out after seeing the documentary. So it does provide that vehicle to, you know, network with individuals worldwide.
It's interesting to me, like you have all these cases sitting next to you, but there's still like most likely a large number of people who haven't actually, you know, reported sightings or anything like that. So, for example, a doctor that I worked for in Illinois when I was living there, he and his dad were, so this is near Peoria.
Okay.
He and his dad went hunting. I don't know what, I guess what time of the year it was, but they're driving at 4 a.m. It's really dark outside, kind of going towards like Macomb, Illinois.
Okay.
And they had to basically stop in their truck because there was a triangular object just over like this homestead. And then it was the very typical description, you know, one light at each point and giant object. And this is a guy who doesn't have an interest in this subject. He had overheard me and a coworker talking about it. And he was just like, oh, I saw this one time. Like, you know, it's like, okay. That's wild. So.
Austin, I love that story for a number of reasons. One, I always say that once someone in a social setting realizes you're open to the subject, they want to try to pull you off to the side and say, hey, I never told anybody this, but, and then they lead into a narrative like that. So it's interesting. People feel like they have to have a safe environment before they can disclose their personal experience. But I like that also because it does really touch on the fact that despite the number of case files that we do have, we're dealing with table scraps, table crumbs. Mm-hmm. The vast majority go unreported. The vast majority that the United States government and other governments probably have in the way of UFO reports, we've never seen or heard of. I think it's naive in the extreme to think that what has been declassified through FOIA or just systematic declassification is all there is. I think that's naive in the extreme. Yeah, it makes me wonder what else is out there that we don't know about. And I've certainly had many people come up to me that tell me a very interesting UFO narrative. And then I ask, well, did you report it? And they say, no, never reported it. The first time. In fact, I've even had situations on numerous occasions where a husband will tell me about a story and say, but I never told my wife, or vice versa. The wife I never told my husband because I knew he wasn't open-minded enough to, even though I'm married to him, he wouldn't believe me. And so it's really interesting. I mean, UFO investigators in a strange way, we're almost like a father confessor, right? You go into the confessional, you know, for Catholics that are out there. And it's like what's said in the confessional stays in the confessional. And even police officers. I've had the pleasure in Illinois as well as other states to interview numerous police officers. And many of them would tell you, if you would have came in here a year ago telling me you investigated UFOs, I would have said, you know, that door works both ways. Just as easily as you came in, you can now leave my office. And so, yeah. And really, this touches on something I always like to mention. people think that because I investigate UFOs, I'm a gullible idiot, that I just believe any story that comes along. And I can't tell you how many times I've had discussions with individuals, both retired military as well as at the University of New Mexico, where I have a great working relationship and where I've lectured on the subject. People will come up to me and say, "You really treat this objectively, don't you?" I said, "I don't believe every story that comes along." And it really touches on, again, the volume of data that we have. It's not that I summarily believe all of these stories, but actually the flip side, I can't summarily discount all of these people. You have to be a cynic in the extreme to say they're all liars, they're all con artists, they're all delusional. I can't do that. And especially when we look at the DOD incidents where you have trained military pilots, if they thought these pilots were crazy or delusional, then why did they continue to fly after they reported these UAPs?
Right. And I think those are particularly compelling because there is a disincentive to have reported them. But let's sort of focus in on that, like the civilian anecdotal evidence, right? Like it seems like there's a paradox between this volume of evidence, right? That it is scientifically irresponsible to discount, right? And yet we also are increasingly aware of how flimsy and unreliable eyewitness testimony and account can be. So what do you take and what do you leave? And what is your process for, interpreting eyewitness accounts?
Absolutely. Great question, Michael. In looking at the eyewitness reports, the ones that I tend to focus on more heavily, if you will, are the multiple eyewitness reports, where you're not relying on one person's perception, one person's interpretation, or one person's recollection. And in my book, I state that's a process, right? Especially when we look at cases that happened days, weeks, months, years ago. It's the initial perception, which, to your point, is reliant on, well, what's their visual acuity? What's their auditory acuity? In order to, you say it's silent, but do you wear hearing aids and were you wearing them at the time of your sighting? I mean, these are very practical investigative things that we need to explore. So you have the initial perception, but then most importantly, I think this is the one where really we get into the weeds when it touches on your question. How do you interpret what you're perceiving? And are you filtering it through your religious ideologies? Are you trying to filter it through your military background? Many of the military witnesses I've talked to that have had sightings, they immediately were trying to interpret it through the lens of what military aircraft am I aware of? What do I know is out there, et cetera, et cetera. And then again, depending on the nature and duration of time from the time of interview to the actual experience is recollection. We all know that memory is fluid at best. And so I think to your point, individual eyewitness testimony is a data point, admittedly a weak one, to your point. But when we have multiple eyewitness reports describing very similar characteristics, that's where I stand up and take a little bit more notice. But to your point, Michael, I said long ago, if it was just people saying they saw things in the sky, I wouldn't have given this UFO subject a second thought. But as we know, in the larger context, looking at the subject, we do have cases involving radiation, burned vegetation, animals, people that have been affected either physiologically or psychologically. We have radar. Those are the ones that I am particularly interested in. The radar visual military reports, again, in their own documents. And admittedly, we have a small percentage of those. So that's kind of the caliber that the radar visual to me are some of the most compelling cases. Again, sure. Not only because we have objective data, not just subjective, to your point, Michael, to your question about visual perception, but here's objective data to back up the witness. And then I think if you have, in addition to that, multiple eyewitnesses, if you have 40 people saying they saw something and you've got radar confirmation, either ground-based radar and or airborne radar, we need to at least look at that. I think, it's intellectually dishonest to just arbitrarily just dismiss it.
That's one of the things, I think well, there are a lot of like debunkers out there who know a lot about cameras, right? And who can tell you, you know, exactly, you know, what's, and can really get into the technical details of that. And I think that's compelling for a lot of people. And then and that's one of the reasons, as we were sort of going through these disclosures, over the last year, you know, is just to point out that, like, you know, the military has multi-sensory, you know, data to back this up. It's not just, you know, the tic-tac UFO, you know, floating off, near the Nimitz, right? It's this whole range of things that we can't see, right? That we don't have it. We don't get access to it, but we know that the military has, you know, these data points.
Absolutely.
But so to sort of continue down this line about sort of the psychological dimensions of the phenomenon, right? Our brains effectively, you know, identify things through comparison, right? Like that's what is sort of happening at the neural level. You know, we recognize patterns, we compare things to those patterns, and that means that when we see something anomalous, right, it's that is the function that's failing. But what is your understanding of what's going on in someone's mind when they see an unidentified object?
Well, I think it varies from individual to individual. And again, I use it as an example, the multiple eyewitnesses, where I've had multiple witnesses see the same thing. They interpret it very differently. And to your point, there is that framework, that mental framework, where we do look for patterns when we're exposed to any type of stimuli. And that's where the skeptics are completely right. Quite often you'll hear that argument used. Well, we're a pattern-seeking animal, and when we see things, we look for patterns, and we try to fit it in, et cetera, et cetera. That's true. What's interesting is with some of the skeptics, and real quick, Michael, I like to always delineate the two groups of skeptics. There are healthy skeptics, ones that bring very good questions and criticism to UFO research, and valid ones. I often say sometimes the skeptics keep us true, keep us honest, and they point out errors in our judgment. But then, unfortunately, you have the oppositional skeptics, is what I like to call them. In other words, Michael, if you say white, I say black. Why? Because you said white. They're just a contrary type of personality where they just love to just incite argument and infuse that oppositional nature. Mm-hmm. With regard to that, though, I think that we have to acknowledge that, yes, we are a pattern-seeking creature. Specific to the triangles, real quick, in going through the 1947 to 1977 files, I found a number of quote-unquote triangular UFO reports that I threw out. In other words, they described seeing three bright points of light that seemed to be moving together, but they conceded, but I couldn't see an object between those lights. But they labeled it as a triangular UFO report. Also in my book, I might add, I threw all those accounts out. I did not include those in my book. Again, because we see three points of light in our minds, we like to envision, well, there must be something connecting them. No, they could be three independent points of light moving in a triangular formation. So just as an example, I completely threw tons of cases out. Now, the ones in comparison that I included in my presentation for this year and in my book are the ones where they said we saw three points of light and the street lights were shining up and we could see a light underbelly of some type of structured object that was between the lights. So that's a different category. Or they say as the object was moving overhead, the moon was out, but the triangle was darker than the background sky because of the glow of the moon. That sets it apart. So, I mean, you know, the devil's in the details, and as I like to say, you know, your argument's only as strong as the weakest link. So any of those ones that had three points of light or they described as triangles, if they did not describe an object or some other suggestion that there was structured something there, I threw it out.
Throughout all of your research, when you've interviewed, we'll say primarily civilians, do you ever come across, you know, details of, you know, so-called high strangeness? when you are talking to people, when they're, you know, I see this object, but then something else sort of weird happens in conjunction with this sighting. Because, like, for example, the doctor that I worked for, he basically described the so-called Oz effect when right. they saw this triangular object. I mean, he literally was like, well, it was really weird because we got out of the truck and then all of a sudden it was like someone just switched to, you know, just hit a switch and then all the sound was just cut off in the local environment. And then it was just gone. Then we drove away and it was back. Like,
yeah, no,
that's widely reported, but you know, there's not like a, we don't have any scientific evidence besides anecdotal data to support, you know, whatever that could possibly be.
Completely agree, Austin. Yeah, I do have some reports like that, similar in nature with complete absence of sound. I will say I've had a number of reports where there appears to be missing time. Now, that being said, unlike a lot of researchers, I do not immediately jump to the conclusion they must have been abducted by aliens. You know, I think that what we're dealing with, and not just with triangular UFOs, but I think your audience that I'm sure is well read on the subject will agree from their own reading and research as well as yours. There might be physiological and psychological effects on the human brain as it relates to getting close to these objects. In other words, electromagnetic microwave energy that impacts our perceptual abilities, whether it's visual or temporal in nature, to where it just kind of scrambles our brains, if I can use that casual term. So I know there's a lot of abduction researchers, as soon as they hear that, they want to throw this person on a couch and hypnotically regress them because it's fitting their agenda. Ah, they must have been abducted by aliens. My attitude is, you know, I'm not going to go there unless we really have to, unless there's other information. But in many of the reports that I've dealt with, again, multiple witness, there's this perceptual inhibition as it relates to understanding time, that it's like I lost all sense of time. The next thing I knew, it was 30 minutes later. It seemed like it was only 5 minutes, but then I looked at my watch. And so there is this weird effect with time, whether, you know, intrinsically affecting time itself or just perceptually impacting the person's concept of time. But I think there's a lot of physiological effects that result in not so much distant UFO sightings, but the true close encounter cases.
Mm-hmm. So we've been putting this question to all of our guests on this topic. And so we wanted to be sure for our own data collection purposes, just to put them to you as well. The basic sort of thrust of this line of questioning is that, you know, we don't want to talk about things on this show like just because they're interesting, right? We want there to be an importance, right? Whether that be, you know, socially, culturally, but, you know, just sort of on a human level. Aside from idol fascination, and that there's plenty to be fascinated by in this topic, why should people care?
Mm-hmm. Great question. And one that I think is exemplified in what we've seen over the last few years with government disclosure. It comes down to national security. We labor under the idea that our air defense is in place, that we have controlled airspace, as I alluded to earlier, that we have safe commercial air corridors. Well, tell that to the American airline pilots here in New Mexico on February 21st, 2021. That nearly collided with a cylindrical unidentified object, or UAP. I filed a FOIA request on that and got the runaround and ultimately did not receive any data, as did some of my colleagues. I filed it literally the next day within 24 hours of the incident, and basically they would not disclose any information regarding it. If we have, as we know, unidentified objects moving through controlled airspace near commercial and military planes, if we have, as the Navy spokesman stated in 2019, when they stated that they were formulating official policy and procedures for naval personnel to report UFOs, that they noted an increased frequency of UAP activity near sensitive military operations areas, how can this not be of defense interest? I mean, you know, whether you subscribe to UFOs being extraterrestrial, you think it's Soviet, you think it's Korean technology, by, you know, definition, if we have unknown objects moving in our airspace, we have to know what those are. And I know a lot of people take some consternation to the idea when people frame the UAP subject as a threat to national security. The key word is potential threat. Because clearly, whatever these things are, wherever they originate from, if it's made in China or wherever else, they clearly exhibit technological superiority. How can that not be of concern to the average American citizen? And up until recently, many people didn't look at the subject, but I'm here to tell you, there are a lot of people waking up to the fact that these things are real with the official disclosure. And I say with a lowercase d, not an uppercase d, as many people envision. You know, people thought they were going to wheel the crashed UFO and dead aliens from Roswell out, you know, and I kept telling people you need to temper your expectations accordingly. But they have acknowledged there is a phenomenon. So purely from a defense standpoint, for anybody that gets on a commercial plane, you should be interested in the UAP subject. For anybody that's in the military working in and around these areas where there's been consistent frequency of activity. And as we know, going back even over the decades, looking at the nuclear and UAP connection, where these things seem to be interested in nuclear power, nuclear weapons, nuclear storage sites, we have to look at that. We can't be an ostrich sticking our head in the sand and just ignoring it. I think that, like I said, I stated in Ross Coulthart's documentary, ignorance is not an option as far as I'm concerned regarding the subject.
I think it's interesting too, in regards to the subject of like your book specifically, the number of military government officials who have taken an interest in that particular subject, one of them being Mr. Christopher Mellon.
Yes.
And he, you know, he demonstrated, at least when I watched the Unidentified show on the mm-hmm. History Channel when that was airing.
Sure.
He took a very kind of particular interest in this sort of subset of the mystery itself. And I thought that was very intriguing.
So. And Austin, a little backstory on that for you and the audience. Chris reached out to a mutual friend of mine in the field. And this is going back, gosh, 4 years ago, I think now. It's been 4 years. With COVID, it's been kind of a blur for me the last couple of years, as I'm sure for you and your audience. I lose track of dates with the last couple of years being so murky. I think it was approximately 4 years ago, my mutual friend, I was coming back from a business trip from El Paso, Texas, and he called me and he said, Dave, he goes, I was just talking to Chris Mellon. He goes, do you know him? And now, mind you, this is long before the Unidentified series, before he really got involved in the subject matter to a large degree in the public eye. And I said, well, I know of Chris Mellon. I said, I certainly don't know him. He goes, well, he wants to know you. He asked me, who's the guy that I should talk to about triangular UFOs? And he said, well, Dave Marler, I'd recommend my friend Dave. He goes, do you mind if I give him your cell number? I never do that without asking the person first. I said, absolutely. I'd love to chat with him. So long before Unidentified ever came on, I was sitting in this very chair where I am right now talking to you. And we had a 1.5 hour conversation on triangular UFOs. And it was a fascinating conversation. And I always tell people, the interest that you saw, Austin, and other people saw on the Unidentified episode, that wasn't just made for TV. Chris and I, you know, years prior to the show, were talking about the subject. And he always said, I'm extremely fascinated with this particular subset. And for many of the same reasons that I alluded to earlier, you know, this is not an ambiguous category of UFOs. They're highly detailed, highly structured, highly reported as far as the prevalence. And so it was an interesting conversation. Obviously, Chris didn't disclose any, you know, classified information. As I always like to say, when you deal with people like Chris Mellon, people always ask me, well, did you ask him this? Did you ask him this? I said, you don't understand. If you're going to curry the favor or attention of these people and maintain it, as I have, I just was emailing Chris just the other day, just yesterday, about something. You have to understand, it's a one-way street in most cases. You know, he wants my information to share with people, but I'm not going to ask these probing questions of him that I know is probably going to cross a line as far as classification and things like that. So I respect the nature of that. I respect the fact that beyond the UFO UAP subject, you know, he served our country for many, many years as the Deputy Secretary of Defense for Intelligence. So you have to understand who you're working with and their position and the sensitivity of much of the information that they were exposed to. So if he volunteers information, great, but I really don't pressure him, just as I do with John Alexander, who wrote the foreword to my book. John's been involved in a lot of classified operations over the years. And if he volunteers information that doesn't violate security oaths, great, but I don't pressure them in any way.
Have you talked to any other, besides Chris Mellon, any other government officials, like, you know, or within the timeline since the New York Times broke, you know, the original Pentagon UFO story in 2017?
No, Chris has been the only one I've dealt with directly, but a little side note, kind of related to that, Austin. I did a local radio show, which I do on a quarterly basis here in Albuquerque, where I live, where we have live callers call in. And it was really great because it was around the time of the American Airlines case that I mentioned back, you know, in 2021. And then we did subsequent episodes. But we had callers calling in, and I was talking about the acquisition of the Project Blue Book material, having Dr. J. Allen Hynek's files here. And a gentleman called in and said, David, he goes, really interested in your archive and in the historical material, specifically your Blue Book material. And he proceeded to state that he was a retired colonel in, lieutenant colonel in the Air Force. And he lived in Albuquerque, and he'd love to come by sometime and go through some of the old Air Force documents. And I said, well, I said, get with the producer offline, get your contact information, and offline we'll try to connect. And we did. About 3-4 weeks later, he came over, but he asked ahead of time, do you mind if I bring a friend with me? And the friend that he brought was a retired colonel in the Air Force who was in charge of advanced weapons development for the Air Force. And the reason I bring this up is that's the closest example I can give you other than Chris Mellon. But I also like to bring this up for one reason. When people say, well, the Pentagon UFO report, it really didn't tell us much, blah, blah, blah. Well, again, doing this 32 years, in all those years, I never had a retired lieutenant colonel or colonel in the Air Force reach out saying, I would love to come and talk to you about the UFO subject. I would love to see your archives. I think it's because of the successive revelations, because of where we are now with the narrative and with the erosion of skepticism regarding the subject, that I'm starting to have, if I can use the term, higher caliber people contacting me and wanting to have conversations. Another one before I forget, there was a gentleman from Nebraska who is a retired Air Force colonel as well. And he reached out and said, and it was rather interesting. I totally forgot about this until just now, it popped in my head. But he said, I'm a huge fan of your research. And I think this was after the unidentified episode at aired, Austin. And he said, I'm a huge fan of your research, and I work with a group of other retired Air Force officers who are looking into the UAP subject, and all of us are following your research. So wow. I thought that was rather interesting. Yeah, and I did very look cool. him up. I was able to do some detective work online, and I did verify he was, in fact, I believe, a retired colonel in Nebraska that had reached out. So the point is that there's a lot of people stepping out of the shadows now, willing to have that dialogue and discuss the subject.
So I guess like the next question I want to ask, and this is further down our outline we sent to you. Mm-hmm. Like we have these people, you know, and these are important people to get engaged on this topic, but they're still, you know, for example, the story I told earlier about that, that doctor, there's still very much a social stigma.
Right.
And like, I guess, what is your sort of take on how we continue to push this forward? I mean, how do we continue to get more and more people interested in this stuff? Because not everyone reads the New York Times, you know, not everyone's watching, you know, these shows in the History Channel. And it's because that's what it's going to take ultimately to get, you know, actual answers on this, is for millions of people in this country to like demand congressional hearings. But even right. even then, is that enough? So,
yeah, you know, there's always going to be obviously subsets within our population that deny the subject or don't want to look at the subject. I mean, we still for God's sake, we still have flat earthers out there that think the earth is flat. I mean, using that as a corollary, no matter, you could throw a dead alien down on your kitchen table and they're still not going to believe it. I mean, you know, people are going to believe what they want to believe, irrespective of as much evidence as you present. And that's just something that we have to concede going into this. But I think if I can answer your question, just kind of through the lens of how I try to approach the subject, there's a lot of popular UFO researchers out there that I don't consider credible. You know, I always separate, you can be popular, but credibility is something altogether different. And on my tombstone, when I die, I don't want them to say he was popular. I would love to see something like he was the most credible or one of the most credible. But I don't have a narrative that I'm pushing other than we need to investigate this more. That's really my narrative. we need to investigate the subject further. We are getting a lot more minds and brains and sets of eyes looking at the subject. And I think the more, the better, because people are coming at it from different perspectives. But I think the best hope we have to really continue to budge the needle in getting more people aware of the subject is not the sensationalism like a lot of UFO researchers, but the work that I try to do. One of the compliments that I get when I attend lectures or do conferences, and it's the highest compliment people offer me, they come up to me and they say, "You know what I like about your research?" And I said, "What's that?" They said, "When you present information," and for those that have attended my lectures over the years, that they will tell you this, "you always cite your references. If you reference a newspaper, you have the newspaper and the date. If you cite a government document, you say what record group it came from." And I said, "Well, I do that for two reasons. One, to me, when I was in college, that's research 101. You cite your references. I mean, right? I mean, that's just common sense. I don't care what you're researching. But two, I hope that what I'm doing is a springboard or a stepping stone for other people to say, you know what? I like what Marler's doing, but I want to investigate this angle a little bit further. I've given you my resources, and I share information with people that reach out to me all the time as far as, you know, I'd like the full case file on that. Can you send that to me?" "Sure, here it is." You know, the only exception that I do is if, even on these historic case files, if the witness requests anonymity, I just black out their name and their address. But I'll provide the information to anybody that wants that. But I think if we're going to try to get the general public on a large scale to start looking at the subject, we have to engage in credible research based on factual documents, presenting the material, citing your resources. So much in ufology today are wild conspiracy tales or unnamed sources. There's one researcher I won't mention by name, but they've made a cottage industry of writing books and lecturing. And admittedly, we do have situations where someone might be in a sensitive position and they need anonymity. But that should be the exception, not the rule. And this one researcher I'm thinking of, they consistently state, based on an unnamed source, "Well, an unnamed source emailed me, an unnamed source, an unnamed source." In other words, you just need to take what I tell you as gospel truth. You know, you can't vet it, you can't judge it, you can't research it any further. I'm sorry, I don't go down that pathway. If I can't try to verify or validate information, and one example I use is some of these cases that I've investigated, Farmington Flying Saucer Armada from 1950. Happened in 1950, I tracked down two witnesses that were still alive. I mean, I went and I tracked them down and I interviewed them. There was a case from 1964 here in New Mexico that was never really investigated thoroughly. I tracked down the witness. I found him. And my wife and I are now good friends with him and his wife. But I tried to track down the witness if at all possible. There was a case from 1967 in Southern Illinois near Scott Air Force Base describing a triangular UFO, which was in my book. I tracked the witness down. He was still alive. So I try to go back to the original sources and even these witnesses in these historical cases in trying to verify and properly vet the information.
Yep. So do you have, I don't know if this was in the book or not, but do you have a particular favorite case that always pops into your head, you know, when you think about this subject?
There's so many. I mean, it's such a hard question to answer, Austin. I don't want to be evasive. I'll give you one example. I reincorporated this into my new lecture for this year because admittedly, there's a lot of new people coming on board that maybe didn't catch my lecture in 2005 or 2012. And so, you know, I'll be prefacing some of these slides that I share. It's like some of you may have seen this before, but we do have new people coming on board, and I want to make sure they're aware of this. One was, and again, through credible sources, Air Force Project Blue Book files, Albany, Georgia. And I did touch on this in my book. In Albany, Georgia, there was a pilot flying at night, and he noticed a very distinct circular light in the sky. And it caught his attention because, unlike a star at night, it didn't scintillate. He said it seemed to have a very sharply defined circular edge. And it was alternating white, orange, white, orange. And it would cycle that every few seconds, white, orange, white, orange. He continued to fly and kept looking at it. And he thought, well, I'll increase altitude. If it's something in the atmosphere, then it should change perspective. If it's a star, it's not going to change perspective much. In the Blue Book report, he increases altitude. And within a matter of seconds to minutes, he realizes the light that was above him was now below him. So it clearly wasn't any celestial object. So based on that, he then increased speed and descended, trying to close on the object to get a better look. And this is one of those high strangeness cases that really just stretches the imagination, but you're reading it in this historic Blue Book file. As he closed on the object, the Blue Book account states that the object continued to alternate color. Then the object, the light, took on the appearance of a dark red triangle, which then separated into two triangles, one directly above the other, which then disappeared. Now, again, and Michael, this gets back to your earlier question, as far as credibility, we have one witness. It was a pilot, you know, and pilots, I think, are a little bit better gauge of distance, size, et cetera, speed. But in the Blue Book report, the Albany, Georgia airport was tracking a primary target at the exact time and location of the sighting. So that's one of those that has always stuck out in my mind, is one of those that demonstrates high strangeness, demonstrates radar visual cases as it relates to triangular UFOs. And I believe that was 1953, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
So an early case.
Very cool. I think my personal favorite, I guess maybe in regards to triangular sightings, is the 1976 Tehran UFO incident. That one has fascinated me for years and years and years.
That one,
I don't think it's ever been properly explained either.
No, it hasn't. That one has so many elements that are highly credible in nature. And it's interesting, beyond the case itself, which we could talk for 2 hours on that case, as you know, Austin, I love to use that as an example of the obfuscation that the Air Force has used over the years. They say that they terminated their interest in UFOs in December 1969, yet we know for a fact, based on individuals from the Iranian Air Force, that General Secord from the United States Air Force went over with an entire contingency of officers to investigate that case. And that was 76, 7 years after Blue Book supposedly stopped all interest in the subject. So that's one example that we know of where that was a bold-faced lie. They clearly were continuing to investigate and look at the subject.
I'm curious, too, in regards to the UAP task force report that came out last summer, because I don't think they really described in detail, like, physical characteristics of objects that were seen in the report. You know, they just said, hey, here's the number of these that happened. You know, they demonstrated, you know, danger to commercial airliners, military aircraft, yada, yada. But I'm curious, like, how many of those sightings were triangular craft themselves?
Oh, trust me. Yeah. When I first read the report, Austin, I'm waiting. It's like, okay. And I got to the end and it was like a movie you watch and it just kind of ends abruptly.
Right.
That was
right.
Like, oh, okay, that's it. Again, it's important in the historical context because it does state that the phenomenon is real. But beyond that, to your point, it lacks that meat on the bone, that specificity. And I knew it wouldn't have much, but I thought, to your point, it would at least maybe give us some insights into shapes, sizes of objects that had been reported. But it was completely lacking that. And the other thing it's lacking, and I do want to mention this briefly, and I'm actually using this at the beginning of my lecture this year. The fact is, if you read that report, and let's say you never, ever heard of the UFO subject before, if you read that report, you would assume that this is a fairly modern phenomenon. They didn't touch at all
past
on the history of the subject. If you read that report, you would think this all started in 2004. But that emboldens me to get out and to lecture across the country to provide the historical case files, because what it doesn't touch on is the rich history of the subject. And as a historian, as a researcher on the subject, that makes me even more emboldened to get out there and share the history, share the historical case files, show the patterns in the data that seem to transcend time and space. You know, similar reports worldwide over decades being reported.
I get why, sort of to a degree, why they used 2004. I mean, it was because of the Nimitz incident. That was the, you know, the Tic Tac UFO incident that made all the headlines, and that was the one the public news. They wanted to start there. But even after that report came out, I mean, I saw just so many people on, like, Twitter in particular that just were basically referring to the start of this mystery in 2004, you know? Yeah. And I'm like, well, okay, so this is kind of like an unintentional disservice you've done a little bit, or intentional. I mean, we don't know. So,
well, I think it was done intentionally, or maybe semi unintentionally, but the problem that you have from a military standpoint here in the United States, and I would say most other countries as well, but especially the United States, if you start going down the path of historical reports, mm-hmm. then you get into this whole quagmire of, well, but why did the Air Force conclude there was no threat to national security when now you're saying it could be a potential threat? And why did the Air Force do this? Why did they say that? It opens that whole can of worms, and it forces them to concede that, yes, we've been denying this for decades. And rather than go there, they just started with 2004, because you can't go into the history without going into the decades-long denials on the part of the Air Force, CIA, NSA, NRO, you name it.
And denials in places where it's very serious to lie.
Oh, know? Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, so it best just not to even go there. And, but again, I was talking to Barry Greenwood, of course, another historian in the subject, and Jan Aldrich the other day. And I said sincerely, I wasn't, just saying this arbitrarily. I feel it's incumbent on people like myself that has this huge archive of historical material. I truly believe it's incumbent on people like myself to get out and try to educate on the legitimate history of the phenomenon, so people have context, because that's what history provides, is context for what we're dealing with today. And so I kind of feel like it's a moral obligation in a sense.
I want to maybe close with this question. The technology that we've been told at minimum exists, we don't know exactly who or what is in charge of it, but the technology that it exists, can it be used, or should it even be used, to improve the human condition, whether that be just, solving issues of resource scarcity, or anything else you can imagine doing with a power source like the one that we think we might be seeing here? Can it be used to do that? And then I suppose the corollary is, should it be used to do that?
Right. Well, I think morally, yes. I mean, if we have these exotic propulsion technologies that seem to demonstrate something beyond conventional jet engines or scramjet technology, anything that we're traditionally familiar with. Certainly, I think if you have an energy source like that, that is a compact, seems to be relatively safe for the environment, lack of emissions, lack of any type of radioactive fallout. If you have a power source, and again, the big word is if we have access to that type of technology, then yes, I think there's a moral obligation to be able to use that for practical purposes, to alleviate the dependence on fossil fuels, to alleviate the dependence of nuclear energy with all the safety implications surrounding that. But again, I'm not privy to whether or not we have access to that technology, or more specifically, and this is where I think people sometimes jump over an important thing. If hypothetically Roswell happened, as the UFO mythology states, an extraterrestrial vehicle that crashed, people automatically assume, well, we back engineered the technology, and what most people are seeing today is back engineered extraterrestrial technology. There are so many leaps of logic in that, and so many things that you have to fill in to support that contention. But if we're dealing with an alien technology, hypothetically, that's 10,000 years ahead of us. I think it's naive in the extreme to think that what crashed in 47, now 75 years later, as we mentioned, the anniversary, that we've A, understood the technology, B, been able to replicate it and master that technology. Again, if you take your cell phone back to Alexander Graham Bell and say this is a phone, he'd say you were crazy. And we're only talking a little over 100 years, human to human technology. If this truly is something extraterrestrial, and say, and I'm being conservative, 5,000 years ahead of us in technology, it would be magic to us.
We interviewed Ross Coldhart and Frank Milburn, and both of them kind of hinted at conversations they've had with their own sources about the danger of this, you know, technology being widely disseminated, you know, to the public, you know. And so it's, I don't know, the technology itself, to me, the more I think about it, it's just the ultimate conundrum, because it's like you have option A, where, you know, this could radically and fundamentally change, you know, the world forever, for in a positive way, or it could destroy us, you know. And then that's even more pressing, obviously, with what's going on in, you know, the news right now, for example.
Absolutely. At the end of the day, it's a tool. And as I like to say, you know, I can build a house with a hammer. I can also kill you. It depends on how we wield that tool. It's right. Intrinsically, the tool isn't evil. It's the person that's wielding it that you have to judge. And so, to your point, yes, I mean, it's interesting that there may be this advanced technology that exists. But, you know, as you alluded to, Austin, with what we're seeing play out in the news right now with Russia and the Ukraine, if we had this technology, why aren't we utilizing it? I mean, we're really concerned about MiG fighters. If we have these triangular UFOs that, you know, can appear, disappear, immediately relocate. I mean, it stretches the imagination to think that we have this technology and we've had it for decades, yet we're still engaged in inferior technologies.
David, I want to thank you again for taking the time to talk with us today. This has been great.
No, it's been fun. I really enjoyed it. Thank you both.
Excellent. And some things like refreshingly different in talking to you compared to, you know, some of the other guests that we've had on. And that's great. That's great. In fact, especially on that last question, I think that you talked to sort of more national security familiar and minded people, and they will say, no, we can't let anyone have this. The parabolic trajectory of the Tic Tac UFO was like 10,000 nuclear bombs. We can't, you know, like that. You'll get sort of that kind of thing. And I mean, you know, maybe they're right.
But I think there might be truth to both sides.
Yeah, it certainly could be.
So any, I want to ask this question too, before we kind of sign off here, any future book ideas that you have going on or other investigations?
Probably one of the highest compliments I have are people asking me, you know, when's your next book coming out? And I would love to write another book, not to write another book like many people that try to make a living doing this, which I don't. I have a full-time career that's very successful. I don't need UFOs to pay the electric bill. I always like to throw that out there because there are other people that are trying to make a living off of the subject. I would like to write another book. I mentioned Farmington. There's never been a book written on this case from 1950. It's a fascinating case. I'd love to write a book on that. I've had a lot of people ask, especially in light of this new data that I've acquired, could you do a follow-up or an addendum report where you could share actual copies, where we could see the actual pages of these contemporaneous reports from the 50s, 60s. That's something that I've envisioned and I certainly could do. I'm, in addition to actively archiving them, I've been acquiring collections. As I mentioned, I just got over 200 recordings just this weekend. I digitized over 231 prior to that. Philip Mantle in the UK, a friend and colleague of mine, he's going to be donating a pallet of UFO case files and material that he's going to be shipping from the UK here in the next 2 to 3 months. So I'm constantly acquiring new data, having to review it, scan it, share it with people. I field a lot of data requests. So I guess the long story is, yes, I'd love to write another book, but at the rate I'm going between work, family, and all the other requirements, it might be when I retire. And lecturing as well. I do love lecturing and traveling because I love to engage with different people from different parts of the country. And even later this year, I'll be in Nova Scotia. And I just love to meet with different people to get their perspectives. And inevitably, Austin, as you can appreciate, as I travel a country, people are saying, can I tell you about my sighting that I had? And so I always ask people, if you want to share a sighting, please send me an email, because it's easy for me to print off or to save as a PDF. And I can incorporate that into my existing data set that I continue. If you tell me, I talk to so many people, I'll forget in 1 to 2 weeks. And so it's like, if it's written down, at least I can go back to it.
Here at COINTELPRO, we are very interested in investigating stories from our listeners who might have witnessed or encountered something unknown and unexplained. Our encrypted email address you can contact us at is COINTELPROMedia@protonmail.com. That's spelled COINTELPRO media@protonmail.com. We can also be contacted through Signal, an encrypted messaging app. The number you can contact us through on Signal is 206-705-8667. You can find this contact information as well on our Twitter page and on our website, www.cointelpro.media. And as always, this is an independently produced podcast. You can support us by subscribing and helping us make more episodes by going to our Patreon page. We'll see you next week on COINTELPRO.